Okay, welcome to Designing Dava 2020 Day 3 Roundup. My name is John and I'm sitting here with Lucas and Zaid as usual. And today we are joined by special guest star Gerard Pretorius, who is a filmmaker, director and writer, currently working for...
Fuel Content.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Zaid, what show is this again?
Oh, the show. It's called The Resource Cast.
There we go. Cool.
My name is John.
It's going very well.
My name is John.
So, this is relevant because day three, it's always quite surprising how tired you are by the time you get to the end of this conference. And I think we're all feeling it a little bit. How are you guys doing?
I'm feeling it. What did I call it? Inspirationally fatigue. There's such a lot to take in. There's such a lot of concentration. Concentration actually tires you out.
Sure.
People don't realize how much your brain actually
uses. You're standing a day, you're actually taking breaks, you're multitasking out to a thing, whatever it is. But
and then you physically, you know, rush after, in between, like for tea break, you rush to the restroom, or you're going to stand in a queue with 30, 40 people in front of you just to get some coffee, and then you're going to pour the molten coffee down your throat to get back inside.
Yes, you're whinging
again. Life is very hard.
Holy shit, whinging.
This is.
But the thing is, when you come next year, you look forward to it again. This you forget about.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's, totally.
It's,
yeah.
You get totally. Like it's always actually
floss,
exciting.
Me and my floss will be next year.
Good. Oh, so you're planning on coming again?
Yeah, awesome. I'll definitely come. No, it was great. I like the fact that I didn't look at anything. I downloaded the app and I wanted to be surprised. I hated the fact when the announcer would bring up someone and says, this is whoever, and she's doing a talk about trees. And I was like, oh, man, they all give a story. And I like my head to work out. I wonder where she's going. And like, ah, trees. Oh, that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, they kind of give a trailer.
Backwards. Yeah. No, I like this. I don't like trailers.
Okay. Is that true in general?
Everything.
Yeah,
I don't like
trailers. He doesn't watch trailers.
Okay.
Yeah. No,
I think that's
he sits in the movie theater and goes, puts his fingers in his ears and goes, la, 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 la.
I think that's super healthy and awesome, and I wish I could do it.
No, I can't do it.
I know, it's hard, isn't it?
No.
It's a way better way to experience movies. But let's keep going around the table with your overall impressions of the show.
Of the show in general, or just today?
The whole show.
You've seen lots. There's always hit and miss at these things, but I think it's personality based. Some people respond to certain things and some people don't. So to me, I'd, in my personal opinion, this was a 75-80% hit rate.
Okay.
Which is, I think, high for anything where you have so much information to come in.
Sure.
And I was saying, I take furious notes because I want to make reference to certain things in this podcast, but in general, the stuff goes and sits in the back of your head. So when you're at a brainstorm later or something like that, you'll mention this thing. Oh, at a Designing Dava talk, the guys did this, that. So this is possible. So it's not overtly that you go out and do something similar to someone right now, but the stuff does get stuck in your brain.
It lives there and then it comes out.
Gerard,
how many of these have you been to?
I think this is my probably sixth Designing Dava that I've attended, but it's my first time in the actual main conference hall.
Oh, you've been simulcast usually?
Simulcast all the way. And that's the one thing I kind of picked up on. Like, when you're in the room, you do obviously tend to get up, like, swept away by the theatrics of it all. And your experience of the talks, I think, is a lot different in a good way, but also in a way that you kind of need to take a step back at points and try and be objective and go, like, if I was just watching this on a screen, like most of us watch a TED talk or the people in the simulcast, would it have the same impact? Like, what is the underlying message and insight and thing that I'm taking out of this versus, like, you know, I'm watching it live, therefore there's another energy to it.
Sure.
And it's interesting once you do that, some of it, suddenly your opinion of what was great shifts a little bit. So I think all in all, like, what I try to do is sometimes, you know, the speaker would distill it to their own kind of like fundamental thing that they want you to take out of it. Other times you kind of have to look for that. And I think that's kind of just what my approach was. So I didn't make furious notes. I kind of just try to take one or two things away from each speaker.
It's a good observation because you'll see in the auditorium when we're on the simulcast side, that something that gets a standing ovation on your side like everybody's looking at each other and someone comes going,
half-hearted clapping.
Yeah,
at
like
best.
Half-hearted, right? Clapping. Like, this what is that all about?
This is also the first year I didn't fall asleep, which says something.
Yeah, no, totally, because it'll be embarrassed.
I had a little, but I was like, I just from sleep.
I think it's interesting, actually, just because you're the only one of us this year who went into the conference. There's a few things. There's definitely a layer of social pressure inside the conference room itself, because you've got the MCs exhorting you to get up and dance around and get the energy up.
Yeah.
And obviously, you're immediately there. The speakers are there. You're much more likely to clap. Meanwhile, on Simulcast, once someone gets bored, they tend to just get up and walk away.
Yeah, exactly. And if everyone's giving this person a standing ovation, and you honestly think, like, well, I don't know if I should.
But you stand
you
up.
You still do it.
Yeah.
Like, and it's, that's a weird social pressure.
We were making
the yoga.
We were making the joke about if there was a seat counter, but counting simulcast seats, people are getting up and leaving, and that was shown at the actual
to the speaker,
it'd be an indication. It's like that clapometer or a popularity thing, because the students on this side or the people this side, if this talk isn't grabbing them, they get up and go and get some coffee. And that's a
leave for lunch.
Yeah, and that's what, if your messaging isn't right, and in the main auditorium, you do feel responsible to sit.
Yeah.
And also clap at the end. I think it's just out of courtesy.
Yeah.
Where it's way more brutal on this side. As
yeah,
a judgment
I think
or speaker.
It would actually be an incredible data gathering thing to have that kind of a seat register, as it were.
Mm.
And then if you looked at the presentations, I think you'd be able to correlate exactly. You'd be able to see just who's grabbing people's attention,
yeah,
and who's not. Another thing would be something that can detect when someone pulls out a cell phone, because, you know, every time something slowed down, half the people in simulcast are going to pull out a cell phone.
Yeah, people take notes on their phones now. So
that's a good point. So
overall,
be some false,
the overall brightness would just be raised.
Yeah.
I really want to know, like, how good was that Woolies bag?
So I have an admission to make.
Yeah.
I was the guy on day two yesterday. You know, like, it's an interesting, you always find an interesting contradiction of thoughts and kind of things happening at these places where so many of the talks are about, you know, changing the world. I mean, the whole slogan is like a better world through creativity, and yet you've got Willy's who's literally giving you a bag full of like lunches wrapped in plastic. And I was the guy who like shouted out that they'd like less plastic when I spoke about Willy's, and it's something I feel very strong about. Why should you walk into a store and have bananas wrapped in plastic?
Sure.
Like, especially for the target market that typically shops at Willy's.
Yeah.
It's like, you can, if it's a thing about like margins, just raise the base price of the bananas and take away the plastic. No one would probably even notice. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, venting a little bit.
Yeah.
But
fair enough.
Look, I think companies, I feel sorry for Willy's sometimes, is that they've created a cause. So now they're being held to a different standard to other people. So, and so sponsoring something like this at least is an indication that they're trying to create the image or trying to move in that direction. So there's a little bit of grace that I understand where you're coming from. There's a responsibility and a certain hypocrisy that happens, but at the same time, otherwise, without sponsors like that, there wouldn't be these things.
Absolutely.
So we're being very harsh on someone who has painted a target on their back.
To be fair, my comment isn't really related to design and art. It's actually more just in general.
Yeah.
But it really does shed a light on itself at a place like this when the context is so often what is environmentally sustainable, what is like the better thing to do for the future. I mean, there are other countries throughout Africa that have banned single-use plastic, and it's an interesting conversation I've had with people, because they go, but how are you going to convince like everyone to do that? And it's like, no, you don't have to. You have to convince like
a handful of people,
grocers or their CEOs to just make that decision. Exactly, and people will very quickly adapt.
But yeah, your view on it as opposed to this movement of this design in Durban, now we've got plastic in it. Just jumping to the designer that did the call on the floor, he mentioned the issue he had about coming to
the awkwardly named Paul Coxage.
Paul Coxage, yeah. Paul was speaking about his his reluctance to come to Cape Town about spending money on a flight and polluting
hotel,
the air and
travel,
all the hotel and everything. Yeah. So you wanted to offset it by doing some work here, and that's where the bridge thing came from.
Yeah, no,
that was quite interesting that he actually spoke about it. I mean, we all make the joke that people that come together for climate change will fly private jets.
Yeah.
50 of them and come to one place.
Yeah,
you know,
the
like,
DiCaprio thing was.
What's the? I mean, the what's the conference they hold in Geneva, which was the ultimate example of that? It's the where all the
eight,
richest people
eight.
In the world.
Something eight.
Is it like the G8?
G8.
No, it's not G8. It's where all the billionaires get together in their private jets and then talk about how to fix the world.
Bilderberg Group.
Anyway, but let's talk about the. So let's get into some of the designs then, since you brought up Paul Coxage, and you mentioned the bridge.
He stood out. Yeah, he's one of the guys that stood out. I liked the bridge concept and how it was something that was just that stood out to him instantly when they were talking about wood. And he was looking at the river, the Lisbeck,
The Upper Lisbeck. I mean, this
Upper
is in,
Lisbeck,
I think it's near the bottom part of Bishop's Court, where they've been transforming that area into kind of a picnic spot.
Yeah, yeah. And people are crossing it on the stones, giant stones. They said, no, that's not always a good idea. And so they came up with this idea of how you would see wood like it at timber places, are they all stacked up, and so that was like inspiration. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it's been built yet. I'm sure it's probably still in production, but
sorry, those were renders.
I think they were renders.
They're really
but
good
I'm
renders.
Sure coming soon
really
to
good, really,
to
really
the
good.
Upper Lisbeck River, you'll see this quite beautiful design for a bridge that he's put together, which does look like when you just see a wood stored in a shed, it's just all long narrow beams, and what he's done is he's moved those beams in and out, offset them up and down, and created what looks like kind of a floating beams of wood,
stack
in
of
motion,
wood, yeah.
Stack of wood,
yeah.
But it is a bridge that crosses that small river.
His other projects were just as cool.
Just before we jump there, very importantly, he made sure that the wood was made from an alien vegetation, which is this Australian gum.
Sugar gum
that is very thirsty. It messes up the groundwater. So they're like, let's chop
all those motherfuckers down.
Yeah, let's chop the Australians down. And
right.
Walk over them. Yeah.
Another project of his that, well, he started off with showing his studio in London, and it was a fantastic initiative. He started this thing called Vamp, and what was nice about it wasn't what, like a sponsored thing. He did like everybody else here has an idea, and he went and put it on Kickstarter to kind of get the groundswell going for it. And basically, it's a little Bluetooth adapter that's beautifully made, just a little square that you put on top of other speakers, and you connect it, and it automatically turns any speaker into a Bluetooth speaker, which connects
to
your phone.
We're talking old vintage speakers.
Yeah, we're talking old throwaway.
The kind from those hi-fis with the two cassette decks that everyone's got
somewhere.
Well,
he just noticed that people were throwing it away in his neighborhood, because he would go for walks in his neighborhood, and he just collected these speakers and tried to figure out a way to use them. And this is a real product that works. Very simple technology, and because we all have an old system, and you feel bad to throw it away because you paid a lot of money for it to have it, but you don't use it. It just stands there.
And you know it kind of works. It's just not compatible with Bluetooth.
Yes. No.
Wait for the listeners. This Bluetooth plugged into speaker system. It's been around for a while. So when I saw it, I immediately looked at the guys and I was like, is he really going to talk about this Bluetooth thing? But the thing that makes it different is that there's this new technology that's now arise with circuit board amplification versus the bigger forms which is very power hungry. And he found a way to integrate that.
Because normally a phone
earphones and headphones, no problem. But to actually drive a speaker, so I mean it's not that loud. But it's, yeah, the technology is being turned into...
It was battery-powered. How long do you estimate that thing would actually power a speaker like that?
It'll be much better than a regular small amplifier. So I would say with that size, depending on the battery inside it, maybe like 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on how loud. The louder you make it, the more yes. battery.
That's pretty right. But the so from an advertising point of view, what I like about it was his steps. So he went like, I have this little idea on groceries. Notice people are throwing away their speakers. Do a Kickstarter, develop the technology, and then campaign it. And it was such a nice system. So when you buy the thing, you get a speaker with it. So he went to landfills and went to go and fetch like these tech where people were dumping.
I understood it differently. I understood that he was, from doing his research, he found out that, hey, the 10,000 of them end up every month. I thought that was...
Where people are dumping these things and just collected them. So, and then, but you buy it and you randomly get a speaker that comes with the vamp.
Lucky packets.
It's like a lucky packet. Yeah. They didn't refurbish it. It's dented and all that stuff. They cleaned them.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Like, that'll cost a lot of money to refurbish a thing. But they make sure it works, and you at random get this speaker, and I think it's a nice way of the novelty of it is enough to get people.
Yeah, one speaker.
It was a very clever value add that didn't cost them anything, but added a lot to the experience.
Yeah,
the reward of actually getting the product.
And then also he got personal with his studio. His studio looked amazing in that really kind of nice way when people photograph very grungy places.
Yeah,
and
beautifully.
Yeah. And when he found out that his landlord was going to basically knock down their studio and to build flats, he had this idea to start using diamond tip drills that almost does like core drilling to mine his studio floor,
the concrete
itself. And what he would do is they'd drill these holes and it would reveal the layers of history in the building. So you could see in this one core, it's almost like a core sample of the history of that building and different layers, all the way down to the old bricks of the stable that the studio was built on. And then taking that and repurposing all that concrete into different pieces of furniture. It was
beautiful, heavy, extremely impractical.
Well, the only thing that was impractical, I think, was the bookshelf.
All those pieces would require
it's they're beautiful. There's where, like, sure. I think in the world of big timber tables, I think it's relative. It's relative. Well. So,
but it was important to show the layers. No, that's the story.
As in any piece of design, that there's a backstory adds value to something. A mass produced, you can mass produce that tomorrow. It's actually quite cheap to make because it's just layers of concrete. But the fact that there's a story behind that's personal about his studio and how the inevitable is going to happen, so let's just kind of lean into it.
And stuff that predates the studio.
Yeah.
They didn't even know. About.
Yeah.
It has meaning to it.
Yes. I remember mentioning to Lucas that, oh, by the way, for everyone's reference, Lucas is the one who makes the most copious notes, as you'll hear. So I mentioned to Lucas that, you know, it'd be interesting to go around parts of London and drill down and find, unearth those strata, because London is very much built on itself, older versions of itself. But as you said, unfortunately, there's also things like Roman ruins and all kinds of historical bits and pieces that if you unearth them, suddenly you're not building anything on that.
Yeah, you don't want to know what's under there. Yeah. As soon as they find a bone, everything stops. In comes the government, in comes
historical societies,
everybody comes in. So if you just plug that hole.
Yeah. But I think it revealed, for the third day, a common theme that I saw with a lot of the speakers, and that is the question of the preservation of history, and what do you do with a history that in some cases is neutral, some cases is negative, some cases is positive. What do you actually do? Like, what's your responsibility as a modern designer? Do you need to preservation is something that a lot of the speakers spoke about, or do you need to reframe it in a context that people can understand and learn from it? And I think there's no one answer probably. It depends on the site, it depends on the project. But I think they did a very interesting thing, you know, like in the kind of broader, bigger picture of history, probably no one would have noticed if the bricks of the stable yard that was there 100 years ago went missing. Like, that's not probably the same as Roman ruins in a lot of people's books, but the fact that they actually turn it into a story and recognize that as a story gives it power and gives it value.
Yeah, I think that was Neri and Hu that you're referring to yesterday is the two, the architecture,
the historical
and the preservation of the with that context of that building, and not build a new hotel, but a hotel out of an old building, which is such a rad.
I like this creative and beautiful way of remembering something or keeping it relevant. As opposed to brushing over it, just like, you know, smash the old colonial building, but rather work with it. So there's a story there. It's like, oh, so this building used to be this, but now it's a bit more, as opposed to it used to be, this is where it used to stand, and now it's building something else.
But I think, like, the one person that did that really well in a very selfless way was Ibrahim Mahoma.
Yeah.
And his take on a lot of that was literally like there's no financial gain, there's no entity supporting this initiative. It was literally him taking objects from the past, recognizing that they've got a potential and a value to still be relevant today, but inspire the next generation going into the future and doing something differently. Like, and but also telling that story, also recognizing the story of its history, not like brushing that away or anything, but also like it's like a beautiful dual purpose that I thought was like really well balanced.
So, what do you? Ibrahim's from Ghana, and he was this. Basically, I think they introduced him as like he makes monumental artworks. And the scale of what he did was interesting. So he'll take things like that of historical significance, whether it be colonial significance or industrial significance to Ghana, and take it and wrap buildings with meaning. So when he, as an example, when he was wrapping buildings, he would take, it was cocoa bean bags.
Jute sacks.
Say again?
Jute sacks, but I'm not exactly sure what was in them. It might have been cocoa beans.
I think that's the material it's made of. So it's almost like a Hessian bag.
Yeah.
And they would wrap historical buildings in Europe, in Ghana, all different places in Europe and in England as they went along. And it's impressive scale and loaded with meaning. But the community, you got the community involved. They would stitch these bags together and cover entire buildings on university campuses. And it made it almost look like the building's hidden. Or something's like, I almost think like it's covering up something, covering.
But the shape comes through. I think it depends on the lens in which you look through.
Yeah,
it could
totally
be covering it up, trying to hide it. It could also be, you know, it's wrapping something old and possibly, as you say, like a negative historical relic in something that is in something new or some part of fabric of life of Ghana, and that speaks. Also to the work of the Italian designer who was working with that pasta company and...
keep forgetting her name.
I know. It's Catalina.
Loretta.
I think.
Catalina.
Yeah. So she, when they weren't happy with... you tell the story, Zaid. I think you know it best.
With Catalina, she boycotted this pasta company because there was comments that were made on the pasta company side regarding same-sex parenting, I think.
Families.
I was not fit for it was not the best type of family, something like
traditional
that.
Traditional Italian.
Traditional something, yeah. And so she felt she didn't like it at all. And she boycotted it by not purchasing any of the products. And what happened was they contacted her to work with her based on the fact that they were changing their ways, to put it. And what I thought was great was that she...
Is it Olympia Zagnoli?
Sorry, it's
no, it's not Catalina.
You told me Catalina. No,
you did, but it's just not that.
No, we said earlier on, you said the name, wasn't it Catalina? So I said, Catalina?
It was good, but now it's broken. But
okay,
this is good. I'm not
again.
Editing any
I'll
of this.
I'll do it again.
No, it's Olympia
really
Zagnoli.
Sorry, dude, it's
Olympia
really
Zagnoli.
Bad. Because early on you said it's Catalina, so I said, oh, it's Catalina.
Did I?
Yes, early on, it's the first take.
It was all you.
You said Catalina.
When
you went through the name.
I'm tired and I have brain cancer.
Okay,
I hate that trump card. It's the worst card. He just throws it.
Okay, so anyway, let's get back on track.
It's
Olympia Zagnoli. She boycotted the use of the pasta, but then when they contacted her to actually revise their opinions on the subject. She worked with him, and that's,
she worked with him. Yeah, that's the best part of that whole story, is the fact that she didn't shout at them. She didn't say, "I want you guys to be destroyed." She became like the bigger person.
She was the bigger person,
and she looked at the bigger picture, and she was like, "You know what? I can actually get a bigger message through working with them." And showing people that other people can change. That you might think people are just evil or just bad or just stuck in their ways. They can actually change, and you need to have a dialogue, you need to have a conversation. And she actually ended up having a design of two women eating pasta on the packaging.
Like Lady and the Tramp style.
Was it Lady and the Tramp style?
Yeah.
But what I really loved about it... It was Lady
and the Lady.
Nice. And I think there's like a broader message that I took out of it, is like, she boycotted them, she had a certain view of them, and then when she thought about it, you're absolutely right, she made that decision, okay, let me engage and at least find out if they have an appetite for this and if there's an opportunity. And when she did, she actually found that the management had restructured, they had started supporting like different initiatives that do support like same-sex marriage and relationships. And I think there's something in there as well, just in the world we live in. Like, you can't just, like, of one thing, forever condemn someone for years and years and years and think that's what it is. Like, people, companies, we all have the ability to evolve. I think that's something that she found, and then saw an even greater opportunity to work with them, and that's part of why they fully embraced it, which I thought was amazing. Which is,
sure,
really a win on all.
We spoke about it, because it's in this... It's cancel culture, that you're dead to me now. And what was also, and the two parties in this case can find a middle ground, not even a middle ground, just adapt and evolve and go, oh, okay, I see your point, and then change. Like, to go like, these people never for sale, kill that person or kill their industry, their livelihood, and not physically, but I think some in extreme cases, I think if you get on Twitter, people say, kill those people. Gets that extreme in their opinion.
Yes,
so, and I'm glad to see something like that, to just go, wait, let's just have a chat about this.
Yeah.
It's not as severe as what you're making it out to be, but in social media especially, it gets that hectic.
It's mature.
And you're right. I got the two names confused. Catalina was the next speaker on the same on my notes, so I apologize for that. But it is.
The thing I often think of in these cases is like, when you're really young, you know, like as a kid, you know, and kind of awkward, but we all happen to be guys around this table. We all already went through that phase of like, oh, girls are gross, you know, like, don't want anything to do with it.
That's not nearly as awkward as I thought it was going to be.
No, but just like that. But that's something that you go through as a kid, and we all can recognize that as a society, and we know that you'll evolve through that. And it's kind of weird that we've got this societal cutoff of like, after a certain point of time, if you have
negative in your closet, as it was perceived that way,
that then you can never evolve from it. And it's like, but aren't we as a biological entity like capable of always evolving and always learning? Like, I mean, you know, like, should there be like almost like a, I don't know, like a rehab for people like that, where you can actually like evolve their thinking, like. It's almost like addiction in a way, like where you can just go, oh no, like that person's an addict, I don't want anything to do with them, like cut them off. Like, but now we've learned that no, it's a disease, it's a state of mind, it's a psychology that needs to be rewired to actually help that person. And I think there's a lot of probably research and thinking that needs to be done in that space to actually kind of try and find a solution that allows for people to continue to grow.
Absolutely. I think for kind of any further listening on this topic, whether you like Joe Rogan or not, he had a fascinating conversation with Sam Harris, and Sam Harris has spoken about it on his own podcast, talking about specifically Kevin Hart and the Oscars scenario, and how no one wants to host the Oscars anymore because it involves being interrogated, your entire past gets interrogated, and every skeleton, every stupid thing you said when you were 18 years old comes out, and it can ruin careers. So the conversation they have is essentially around, we have to find a path for forgiveness, we have to find a path for reconciliation for people, for the things that they might have said and done when they were younger, dumber people. So But that is a much, much bigger conversation. Mm-hmm. Who should we move on to next?
Sajjad Das, am I saying it right? Sajjad Das. Architecture Social Club.
Right.
He did the window installations. You guys remember what about
the wooden square waves that I was just like, wow. I love that.
This was probably going to be the hardest one.
Again, Strandpiest, sorry.
Again?
Strandpiest.
Oh, yeah, that's kinetic. Right. But it wasn't that in my opinion.
No, in my head. That's
but what he did, what I liked about it was the research involved in doing just a window display for what was the building?
It was for
it was a department store.
It was a department store, but not the one that Rick Grimm talked about.
Not Louis something.
Sorry, man.
It wasn't Liberty.
It was the Liberty building. So he figured out that this company had such a rich history and came in boats, and very specific boats named Liberty as well. So then the building was built in the same proportions as the boat, and then started sketching out the story of arriving in the country.
And it used the wood.
It used the actual wood as well. So, and if you go and research the Liberty Building, the detail that went into these little mechanical things that made waves, and the wood, the carved wooden boats, it was absolutely
23,000 parts
of animals, and it's this entire building that just became this billboard for beauty and craft. I just thought like the way that they did that was fantastic.
And it's a very visual thing. If you're online now, or if you want to look at it later, it's the Architecture Social Club is his studio who did the work. And if you look them up on Instagram or the website, you'll be able to see it. It's this massive installation across multiple windows in the frontage of the Liberty Building. Essentially, it felt a little bit like the OCD version of It's a Small World After All, the Epcot Center ride, where all the little animatronic guys are waving at you, but an incredibly detailed.
Yeah, it had like a watchmaker.
Yes. Yeah, like gears and everything.
The
other project that they did was this responsive canopy of sorts of these little flowers that pop out of like little tubes.
But it had sensors. The Microsoft project, I believe.
Was it a Microsoft project?
Yeah, that's like right. Also, they contacted you.
Basically, the installation sensed if people walked past it. So these little flowers, not little flowers, bloomed above you and followed you. So it had this very organic feel for something very mechanical. But I just want to talk to Harold about his last piece. So this was one of those cases where people kind of stopped listening, because they went into the little lights. There were lights all over the stage, and we were looking at it as on a screen, so we couldn't experience it. We weren't sure what was happening on stage.
The issues with the video on our side as well.
We thought it was a hologram.
We suspected it was
hologram-like. I suspected that how they did it was just projection through different mediums. So, and then like one part of it being closer to you, and the screen in the back, so you create a sense of depth, because you are projecting from different angles, and some of it is like moving right in front of you in a certain very ordered, like way that's got a lot of order to it. And then background, it's like a little bit more chaotic, but your brain kind of just fills in the blanks and sees all the patterns.
So it looks like a hologram. Basically. It must have been quite I suppose, because we just saw it in 2D.
So it was way better than
it was way more 3D.
Yeah, like a really bad Instagram video.
On our side.
No, it was
one
amazing.
Of those you had to be there.
Yeah.
Also,
a lot of his work, I think he's been collaborating with a composer called Max Cooper. He also gave a specific shout out to him, which I thought was absolutely amazing. I don't know how the sound was in simulcast, but it was pretty
catchy. Yeah, it was. That particular piece was, we could hear quite, the music for us was the main part of it.
Yeah.
It was great.
But the visual, it was, I think, because we were sitting there going, well, we're missing something here.
But I think you nailed it. And it seems to be a through line with all this work, is that the blend between organic and mechanical or digital, and trying to soften those things so that they feel very warm.
That's where you got it right, because they talk about the way that these things make you feel. Technically, great, awesome, rad, their little flowers bloom. But the feeling you get from
seeing... So made them with paper, just to give it them the organic side, and they feel like unfolding flowers.
That's it.
Because everything else about it is... you know, motion controlled LED lights. It's a hanging lighting installation. It's quite mechanical. So we saw that as well in the synchronized drone work with the murmuration of drones. And I can't remember the name of that artist now. I think it was at Gourdain. We talked about how they got the drones all in sync, but then they had to spend ages finessing it, and the engineers couldn't understand what they could
feel.
Why
do you, what do you mean feel? Like we were saying, like, that's the worst feedback you ever get from anybody if you're working.
Any client. It doesn't feel right. It's like,
oh, yeah. Okay, I'll go make it feel better. You know,
but yeah, I suppose it alludes to that thing of the magical thing within an idea that's hard to vocalize sometimes, or pinpoint, like the thing that just makes it like feel right.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
but it's usually up to one person or yeah. two people that or whoever's driving that project. Yeah. So that's not a democratic process at all.
But there was someone who, and you're absolutely right, who said that in, I think it was maybe even the first day or the second day, almost like as a throwaway comment, and the advice was like, create something for the individual, because if you create something for an individual to feel something, there are going to be millions of other people that identify with it. So don't worry about trying to ask for millions of opinions. Just do something that's true to one person and being a human correctly, and by implication, like, it'll resonate with a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm. It could be one of the things that gives an aura of greatness to people like Stefan Sagmeister, who feel like a little bit of an emperor in their own studio, it needs that singular vision to drive it, to go, this is what I want, and I'm going to, Stanley Kubrick's the same, right? And that kind of self-obsessed mania gets something that feels personal, rather than a studio-produced film with 15 writers all trying to find what is the best practice for writing this comic.
And the most recent person I've heard say that was Taika Waititi, who just, like, you know, they invited him into the kind of Marvel world, and he was like, well, this is my crazy idea. And it is so different, and it, like, has just led to everyone taking notice, but he carries on doing that. Mm. He's not changing.
So Jojo Rabbit, I was watching his Oscar acceptance press talk afterwards. I don't know I haven't watched Jojo Rabbit yet, but apparently it's a serious book. The original book is serious. And he met with a writer, and he told her, unfortunately, she realized he's not capable of doing serious. So whatever he's going to do is going to be what he rewrites and revisions. So he used it as base, but he turned it into something very special. And Taika Waititi did a TEDx talk as well. I don't know if you watched the New Zealand talk of his. It's because he goes, like, I'm an artist. Right now I'm making film, but I'm an artist. This is what my vision, my illustrator, he showed his illustrations. But even that TED talk was like a stand-up comedian doing his thing. So yeah, I completely agree. But it takes a certain amount of ego to go, this is my way or the highway. And then comes the finesse of getting everybody else to accept that, because I'm not going to buy. Like, how hard would it be to get everybody on board with one person going, it's my way, get out? It's actually getting people to buy into your thing. And totally. That's where the soft power or the soft...
The soft power of a director.
Yeah, of to go like this... Do you all agree this is where we're going? Mm. Then this is where we're heading.
Yeah.
And I think it's, in the end, it's probably trust that turns into.
Yeah. I mean, just to make one kind of final comment before we move on to Rick Brim. I think when you talk about the through line of the organic and technological, maybe, and this is just postulating that in a kind of a post-industrial world that we're in now, we've seen plenty of industrial machines acting in perfect harmony, perfect unison. And now we've got this world of technology, including AI, which is trying to portray itself as natural. It's trying to feel more natural. And that's why when you do a drone display, if it looks more like a murmuration of birds, then it just feels, it creates a big, better feeling than if they all just floated up into the air into a perfect cube, and then rotated the cube, and then turned into a circle. You know, that aura of naturalness was lost.
Just a comment on drones. When I saw the first years ago, when they started doing these like kind of very elaborate dances with drones, I just went, "Oh, this is scary. This is so scary. Because that thing's going to come and kill someone.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it. They're going to
just rise of the Valkyrie in the back.
Like, because you know, someone's just going, just put a bomb on that.
Just stick a grenade on that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about, for me, the MVP of the day was Rick Brim from Adam and Eve DDB, described in his bio in the app as the chief creative officer of Adam and Eve DDB, which was named Advertising Agency of the Decade by Campaign Magazine. Brim has over 20 years' experience in the UK ad industry and is one of the most applauded names in the game. Okay, that's a particularly useless description. Go note-taking guy.
Okay, so Rick came up, and I'm all of a sudden I feel my voice going a little bit deeper because I'm trying to be a little bit more like him. Some ad guys have a superpower where he's a big guy, but he filled the room more than he, like, more just by physical. By his presence. So he started talking, and he opened it up with, I'm going to swear. If you're offended by this, fuck off.
Apology.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Sorry. And so we're all like, oh, and then it's flipped.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Sorry, I didn't. But
grab the attention right from
he grabbed the attention from the beginning, saying he's gonna swear. And there's an honesty that happens in that. And he told, like, I just love the line, if you're going to be offended by it, fuck off. And it sets the tone. And so we go, oh, okay, so in my head, it's not going to be work. It's not going to be have any of the stuff. We're going to talk work now, real world stuff. Because Design and Darba tends to
get... And there's an entertainer in front of us.
Of course. And also, the subject matters. Design and Darba has a better world through creativity, not a fucking better world through creativity. You know, there's a tonal shift that happens. And he had my attention from the get-go, I guess because I'm an ad guy. And also a personal philosophy that he says we look for what the fuck moments. So if you have an idea and it gets that reaction of what the fuck, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make this, or what the fuck is that idea, it's so weird or so strange, it just resonated with me really, really strongly.
Yeah, the moment he said that, I thought that is Lucas's philosophy.
I agree.
Don't be afraid to do something stupid.
And his two things were basically was the what the fuck thing and like say something stupid, like,
yeah,
almost like trying to inspire you, and he made a few references to young creatives within their agency that came up with some of the work or the kernel of the idea that was the stuff that he showed, and I thought that was great. Like,
and it might be, do you think that's something specific to the advertising industry, that given the continuous group brainstorms, the acceptance of we're going to say stupid stuff, but nothing's off the table?
Well, he specifically addressed that. He was like, of course they're fucking stupid ideas.
Yeah.
Which is true. Like, but I don't think there's any harm in like voicing them, because like my philosophy has always been like, of course you've got like 50 ideas or whatever, and like 99% of them are pretty shit, but that's fine. Like, the only way your subconscious and everything can move on past them is by getting them out.
Yeah, so I'm going to reveal a little bit of Gerard. So I worked with Gerard. I was a creative director at Jupiter, and Gerard was a senior copywriter there for a couple of years as well. And in the brainstorming process, whenever Gerard would bring in ideas, there'd be like 25 fucking ideas on the table, but like crazy, silly, stupid, rad, amazing, beautiful, but the whole spectrum. But you have to bring them all in, you have to discuss it, and have to have that almost kind of don't put a filter on it. And the what the fuck moment goes, if you don't have a what the fuck moment, that means there was too much of a filter. So yeah, somewhere in the middle there's going
to
be something.
It's always been my problem, is holding back from that what the fuck moment, always trying to think about the practicalities of that execution where you don't know how you can possibly do it, and I kind of go, oh, that's going to be too expensive for the client. I find it difficult to break that barrier, whereas you've always run straight over it.
Yeah, I try and run as hard as possible at that wall, and maybe it breaks.
I think it kind of harks back to one of our creative mentors is Ross Charles, who was the ECE of Jupiter Drawing Room since its inception, and his thing was that if you start up at the top, it's going to get pulled down. If you start up here, it's going to get pulled down to here by the time you're done. And I know I'm gesturing on a podcast here, but imagine my hand up high and then halfway down. So that's what clients, the rest of the people you're working with, the project managers, you're all MD, they're all going to pull it back. So you have to run fast.
Yeah. I must admit, the ideas that he showed were just very, very clever ideas. They'd work with FIFA, the computer games, and I'll go into what the actual things were. They did great, crazy Harvey Nickel campaigns where they let people, they took videos of people stealing Harvey Nickel's products and then made commercials out of those. And what I appreciated out of this stuff, it wasn't so lofty. So again, with the audience being the judge of the work, the audiences, in the simulcast at least, would clap very appreciatingly at these like very kind of lofty, beautiful ideas from the other speakers. In this case, they were clapping and cheering and like laughing and rolling on the floor at what he was saying. And it was, the reaction was just completely different because he didn't have that pressure on him to change the world. It was just to change your mind, win you over, show you a product and charm you into liking that product. So that was a big observation that I noticed. And the cynic in me goes a little bit that the reaction, people want to respond to, actually want that type of stuff versus the lofty things. So if you really admit in your heart of hearts, you want to be entertained. Break. You want to be entertained.
But he's more inspirational. He's more inspirational in terms of getting something done. Because the whole what the fuck thing is like, you know, like you said, don't hold back. Like, think of it. Go crazy, push it to, like, you know, past the limit, and then work out something from that. Again, like Lucas said, it's very different to thinking outside the box or coming up with a different idea. I think it's more motivational and inspirational for him to actually say, like, what the fuck, just go for it.
Yeah.
I got that from
you. The first idea that he showed us was the Marmite DNA kit. So Marmite for years have been working, and we all kind of, all the way in South Africa, we know this campaign of it, you either love it or you hate it. And that brand positioning stands there. And they took the DNA technology, or the illusion of the technology at least, I'm not even sure if they really did it, but they got, they DNA sequence you to find out if you predisposed to liking Marmite or not. And
genetically
predisposed. Is that right? Am I using
the reference is, I think, was it coriander? And what's the other thing that people are genetically predisposed to either love or hate? There's another food. I think, well, some people, for example, hate bananas for some reason that I don't understand. But my wife hates coriander. Says it tastes like soap to her, but I don't get that. So they're just admitting the truth that with Marmite, it's very much love hate. And in this case, as you say, they're using those.
There's some science
mouth
now.
Swabs
yeah, this
saying. Yeah. So they actually did a study, and then they leaked that study as the first part of the campaign to the press, who just loved the content piece of the new science study shows that you're probably genetically predisposed to love or hate Marmite.
And as he put it, like it was just tapping into an existing cultural phenomenon, like that was already established, just leveraging something that it's been a long time establishing.
Yeah, and then they made commercials out of it. The idea of like different families, different people finding out that they'd like it, or do you really like Marmite, or don't you really like Marmite? And I won't do it justice by explaining the commercials, but it had people in stitches.
Yeah, all the tropes of a family.
Yeah.
Discussing the truth about
finding out if you're gay,
teenage daughter,
finding out if you're
adopted. Everyone could connect to a different scenario.
It was just such a nice, it's such a nice story.
Well written.
The last one, Fight Funny in Love, the John Lewis commercial with and then explaining the DNA of John Lewis commercials, of the Christmas ad, and that they have so much pressure on them as an agency and himself to come up with something amazing because that wins awards. And
he said from June, that's all he can think about.
Yeah, we used to work on Musica, and it was, you start working in March already on the Christmas campaign because it's such a big thing, but it's nothing on the scale. But him breaking his own rules were another thing, because they set up certain rules for John Lewis ads, like they don't use celebrities, you don't, what was that?
Tell your own story.
Tell your own stories, don't tell other people's stories, we have our own things to say. And they've said, with those rules, made beautiful commercials. And then him breaking their own rules at the end by using a celebrity, by using the music and telling someone else's story, like Elton John, telling the story about how he got his first piano in reverse. It's just amazing.
But what I also loved about that was how he wasn't convinced. And a lot of the ideas, he was like,
no celebrities.
I'm not sure.
No celebrities. Like,
Yeah, and
but he showed it to clients. Anyway.
But he showed it. Well, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And he, in the John Lewis case, he said he had three people like that. He knows he can trust, and he'll bounce the idea off of them, and they don't have that pressure that you were talking about. And they were like, "Yeah, this is a great story."
So in the realm of storytelling, him telling that story is showing that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that's important in this. A lot of the design and office speakers, I tend to look up to them so high. Like, these are amazing architects, amazing illustrators, amazing designers. And you go like, oh, how are you going to do this? And when he admits it, that he has insecurities about these ideas and he has to go and get help, was a very nice moment. And I think in that spectrum, again, like in normal ad guys, usually like, so let me show you what I've made, my portfolio. Yeah. And I'm like, ugh.
Well, that's certainly the stereotype. But if I think about, and I've obviously missed a few years, but the ad guys that I've seen speaking at Design and Dava, and to some degree, I'm sure they write their presentations carefully, it's premeditated, they structure things carefully, and they're professional communicators. To another degree, I think that some of them are just, they just have picked up how to tell a story, how to get their attention in the middle, and then how to take the audience on a journey and tell them a story and make people laugh and know that it's about entertaining, and actually that your proof points can be secondary to just making people laugh and align with you and to think that I'm with this guy, you know? And we've seen some John Hegarty spoke a few years ago.
Many years ago.
And he was quite a few years ago, and he was great. And then there was another British creative director and they all did the same thing. They were professional salesmen to a degree, and salesmanship is telling stories, and it shows in the audience's reaction. A little bit like Robert Wong, creative director, also a salesman, and people reacted very strongly to him, and some of the very amazing projects presented by scientists didn't get the reaction that they should have, because I don't think they are necessarily trained in those skills.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think that kind of comes back again to that little test I kept doing in my head of watching the person like deliver the content live in front of you, and it's amazing, but having to kind of go, okay, wait, I've got to take a step back and actually just listen to what they're saying. Isn't that amazing? But then also doing that with the people who you might have felt like their delivery was a little bit underwhelming, but like the actual content and the actual idea, if you just look at that, is way more amazing than it felt like in the room.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you have to kind of judge it on the merits of both the storytelling and the content, and you have to think about it. You can't just go, "Oh, that made me laugh. That was genius," and walk away from it.
Yeah, but it is a powerful tool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think something to think about when you are doing a presentation to a client is, can you grab their attention at the beginning? Are you telling a story that's personal? Are you showing some elements of yourself to the person you're presenting to in order to make them feel like they're sharing something with you, sharing a journey? But let's talk about that. Let's talk about, is it Jean or Jian?
I think it's Jeannie.
Jeannie Gang, according to this, one of the most important architects of her generation. She was named one of the top 100 most influential people of 2019 by Time Magazine, the 2016 Woman Architect of the Year by Architectural Review. Her award-winning multidisciplinary practice, Studio Gang, is driven by an ethos of actionable idealism. And speaking to that storytelling and that bringing your character through, her little tiny touches of that she's a birder and she's an avid bird person, and so many of it works into her architecture in terms of what is the name of the technique where you etch the glass so that birds don't run into it.
She said, I can't remember it now. But it's basically so that it takes down the reflective nature of glass so that birds don't fly into it. Yeah. And she mentioned a horrible stat, like how many
billions
of birds dying in city. Dying in cities of bird strikes, well, not bird strikes, flying into glass. And her worry about it is building their own head offices with the techno, with the, this type of glass that doesn't kill birds, and then having a rooftop garden that has, that's kind of like a little
wild
garden with insects and
wildflowers.
It's just beautiful. And when she started with that personal story, and then the next project would be, what? It's such a big building, another big building with
massive building next to the High Line. Yeah. I mean, it's as prestigious as it gets in New York.
But what I loved about she had this graph up on the screen, which you can almost like just describe as circles within circles. But it boils down to the one thing she said, and that's basically that we all belong to communities, different communities, whether we like it or not. And I think that's so true for people to try and remember. It's like we try and think of, or we often think of ourselves as like you as how you function within your family or within work or where you live. But actually, that's just one circle within the greater circle of your city. And that city is a circle within the province. And that province is a circle within, you know, the country.
She broke it down in very nice ways of saying it. So it was one, the first, so self.
Yes.
So that's why she shared her story of her interests, and that related to the building. And then the family was what her studio's initiatives were within that building, and bringing in her neighbors and stuff like that around to also start gardens, possibly. So they're just to go. And then the third one was community.
Friends. Family. I think family and friends were two separate circles. But
was it?
Spoke of them, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
My bad.
That's all good.
Yeah,
and then after that, you went to community.
Then it was community. So it was those three essential elements that just inform all this stuff. So even build one of her big buildings that had balconies that you shared, so that you could meet your neighbor and your community. And so that,
what did you think about that? As a, would you want to stay in that building?
So there was again on the previous days, architects, when they spoke about end of privacy, so your neighbor could see you naked through the window one day. That's right. Not the end of the world. It's one of those kind of things. My knee-jerk reaction is, no, I want my privacy. I want my balcony. I don't want to share any of that space. But if I'm forced to, I do interact. We are going to be living in tight quarters, so you might as well know your neighbor.
Yeah. Lyndon and Rosanna from the Chinese architects.
Yes.
Yeah, but a lot of architecture is about how to design a space to make you happy. So what happens a lot with architecture is that they actually look at the human being and the spirit, and they say stuff, they work on stuff like, you know, if you're going to be inside a box with no windows, you're going to be depressed. You're not going to be happy. So they're always trying to connect you to the outside world because that makes you happy. So something like sharing your balcony, again, making you happy as opposed to being introverted and maybe staying by yourself. So it's the nudge.
I think it's challenging, but you can see how that would lead to, I saw it in Barcelona, where neighbors know each other, they can see, because all the balconies in the city can usually see each other, and then they end up having, you know, tapas and drinks in the evening together. It's much more of a community-based thing, whereas, you know, where, like, I think the kind of cultural reference for me is much more, everyone is in their own specific box and don't talk to each other ever, and there's very little community, and, yeah, so...
But it's weird also, because, like, there's also another tipping point, like where I grew up and my parents farmed, like, because you're so far away from each other, people, like the guys, your neighbors, you know, who live 10 kilometers away would just drop in and be like, hey, like, are your parents here? You know, can I have some coffee? And your parents aren't there. You end up having coffee with someone who's like 30 years older than you, which is maybe a little bit weird on one hand, but on the other hand, it's actually very enriching. Like,
sure.
It's very cool. And it's because of the distance that people crave being together. Like, think often like cities like Cape Town, where in that gray area where you are close to other people, but you want to be far away, and therefore you don't make an effort. I don't know, like, and then the balcony thing bridges that gap, which I think is cool.
Yeah, cities are full of lonely people. You know what I mean? It's such a strange... It is... I think it's a clever move.
Yes, from the perspective, to
do that, so that a building can affect behavior. I think that's the...
And you can
sell
it as that. You know, right up front, when someone's interested in moving into that place, you say, well, this is more of a social space, and here's how the architecture affects that.
Well, that's why they build gyms, and they try... They build gyms and all these type of things into modern places and communal pools, and you hope that that creates a community.
Yeah, accidents happen, yeah. Any other pieces by Jeannie that you want to talk about?
I thought the big thing about the Chicago cleaning up that lake, and then she built the
boathouse.
The roadhouse. Yeah. There was a long story about her arriving there, about how the river was polluted, and they finally got the mayor behind her to clean up the water, and then suddenly they had to make it a communal spot, and then it turned into the boat.
Yeah, the boathouse itself was actually fascinating in terms of design thinking, if you will, that because the basically, if you, since you're listening to this, the boathouse looks like a series of kind of M's and W's, peaks and troughs, V's and
based on the road, yeah,
and teepee. I was going to say teepee shaped, but upside down V's essentially.
Yeah,
and those designs replicate the movements of a rower in a scull boat. So it's got in the movements of rowing, you move the oars, your hands down and up, and the building itself replicates that movement. And inside, to make it all kind of make sense, it's a boathouse that contains rowing boats for rowing clubs.
But people use it for yoga.
And
as well.
It gets used, apparently everything she makes gets used for yoga, yeah, as well.
Yeah. Yoga got the clothes.
So there was also something interesting, and it was so nicely that she named it. She called it solar carving, which I thought was an interesting concept. So usually a normal building goes up as a big rectangle, blocks out the sun. So mapping the sun's movements, they could figure out where to carve the building so it has indents and kind of to maximize the sun coming through the building into a certain space so that courtyards and things like that have
that
maximum
brilliant.
Sun. It's taking the science... taking science and applying it to architecture to make it more human, because people want crave that sunlight.
Yeah,
very, very well very put. Cool. And the balcony example, which she called network balconies or balcony networking.
Yeah,
just nice way she categorized things.
Sure. So I think definitely a theme that we maybe picked up on running through is the mix of the human and the technological. The interaction between history and modern, any other kind of useful two-word phrases you can think of that stuck out to you?
As an overarching theme for Design Innova or her stuff?
Overarching. Let's wrap it up.
Okay.
Yeah, what came out in her work, but a lot of the people's work, is like, be personal about your work. Like, don't be afraid to make something that, you know, you strongly believe in and that resonates with you as a person. Because inevitably, like, that is gonna resonate with other people. Like, I don't think there's anyone in the world that's so insular that when you make something that no one else is gonna kind of get the same reward that you are at. That's enough. Obviously, when the stars align and that is something that fulfills the purpose and ticks all the other boxes and being practical and thought through, then that's where the magic kind of happens. But it all starts with that.
That's important to you.
Yeah, I think that thing that most creative people will be able to recognize, it's like that initial idea, that little thing that before you even had a chance to ask yourself, is this stupid, like, that actually just energizes you. And if you just follow through on that, like, and that's the other thing, a lot of the speakers recognized their failures. Like, they would say, like, oh, these, by the way, are just our successes, never mind the thousands of pitches and competitions we lost. And I think that's something that everyone should also remember. It's like, it's the stupid shit thing, you know, like, you have to say a thousand stupid things before you get to the 10 good things that are, like, unforgettable.
Sure, and I think that's, I was going to say, it's a good thing to remember, is that we are seeing the best of their work, the successes that worked, because most of those what the fuck moments or stupid things, as you say, don't happen. There are also quite a lot of examples where I can think of a couple of examples where the presenters talked about, oh well, I needed, for example, bass timber, I needed some sleeping bags, so I went to a sleeping bag factory and asked them for sleeping bags, and they said, oh, of course you can have some sleeping bags. It was all, I'm sure the process wasn't quite as easy as that, and I'm sure not every step in that overall process was that easy, but you know, it makes for a good presentation.
Yeah, I'm sure there are 4 sleeping bag companies that never replied to his email, you know, like,
sure,
but yeah, the point is, you keep trying, there is probably someone who will.
I think also, to your point, the trick is you'll keep trying if it's something you want to do.
Yeah,
it has to start with that inkling of, this is something I'm interested in. If it's not something you're interested in, you're going to drop that project very quickly.
Or if you're doing it for someone else.
Yes. But even if you're doing it for someone else, it must be something that interests you. That
sure.
It must be both parties. If you're doing something for a client, that you must get something out of it, and they must get something out of it, and the public must get something out of it, I suppose. And that, I think, will make for the magical project. But I'm saying it so easily because we've all had to do things that we just don't agree with. But in the end, it might be a part that you're not seeing or that you're not understanding, etc. So you have to find always that little correlation, I guess. But overall, there was, I think one of the hosts mentioned that you feel small when you look at this stuff. You feel very inadequate because these are very talented people. But like you said, those little glimpses in the failures bring them down again. And even in the presentations, I think that's the trick, is not to impress, is to inspire.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference.
Or to compare, because as we said, the goal of this thing is to inspire change through design and creativity. And most of these designers are changing the world on some fundamental level, healthcare and science, and they're doing what we consider big things. When you're a freelance web developer creating a website for a shoe company or something, it's easy to feel like you're not doing anything of value, you know. But I don't think that's necessarily, true. You don't need to beat yourself up because you're not the one making ambulances in Bangladesh to save your life.
Yeah, and I mean, like the, you know, Rick, his work, the John Lewis work, all that stuff's amazing. Obviously, he's not going to spend his time showing us all the brochures, the design.
Yeah,
you know that, like.
Absolutely. But John Lewis sales.
Yeah, exactly.
Point of sale.
We all know that's part of it, and that actually chews probably up way more time than anything else.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting, one thing I've noticed throughout the years with design and other is like how people used to talk about, like, you know, so I had this idea, or I did this, or I did, and how it's progressed. And like, what I really appreciate is when people recognize that, when they talk about a we, they make it clear, even if it's just for a moment, that when I talk about we, I talk about our studio. I'm not talking about we as like me and my co-founder who's standing on stage. And it's like, again, Rick, like, his, you know, recognizing, oh, like, we have this young creative start out, and he threw out this idea, and here's the case study video, and everyone applauds. Like, that's cool. Like, you know,
it reflects well on you.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be you, but it reflects well on you.
Yeah, it's like
he's enabling great work.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think, is there any?
Oh. Yeah, as the new guy.
As the newbie.
No, I was going to add to that, but new guy. Well, look, if I have to think back and reflect on this design in Dubai in a couple of years, my overall vibe about this and how it connects to myself is about growth. And what I mean by growth is seeing what, like, Manu, what he did based on things that were accessible and around and working with that. I forgot the other guy's name, that how he looked at it and said, we have tuk-tuks, and then let's do something with it. We've got these old buildings, let's clad it rather than smash it. And how Niri and you, they kept the old with some of the new. So what I mean by growth is the change where, with growth, when you get older, you're still you, but you're stronger, you're wiser, and you have your memories with you. So I look at it more as this being more change within evolution, an evolutionary type thing than revolution. So it's a complete change, is like wiping everything off and having to start something completely new, versus like, hey, we have trees that can already do this kind of thing, why not let's work with the trees, as opposed to let's come up with something completely new and then it takes forever to get there. So that's my take.
Yeah, I think the kind of two reactions that I've always had going out of Design Dava are either feeling totally pumped, quit your job, go and make art, and the other reaction is always, oh my god, I feel useless after seeing these people, I feel tiny, you know. But I think the thing to remember as well, when you're talking about wisdom and after the, when you, as you build a longer career, the body of work you create is always post-rationalized, it's always mythologized to a degree. You only see in hindsight, these are the things I've made and here's the golden thread that links them all. It's very hard to see ahead into the future that this is the body of work I'm going to do. And there are a few, we call them visionaries, who see this is my line, that's what I do. But for most of us, it becomes kind of all in retrospect. And all of these people are creating and telling a story about their past and their work. And that's good, because why not tell a good story? Why not tell a story to yourself where you're proud of the work you've done, and forget about the brochures and the point of sale and the failed presentations and the retrenchments and everything that you go through in order to create that work. It's more helpful in the end, I think, to be able to still be inspired and to be able to be uplifted by other people's great work. I'm going to step off the soapbox now. Any final words before we wrap up? It's been a long week. It's been 3 big days, and I think we'll need another year to recharge before DI 2021. I'm sure we'll be back. Last words, go, Zay.
Thank you guys for bringing me to Design in Dublin.
Dude, thank you. It's been awesome to have you and your perspectives. Kirill, thanks for joining us on this last day.
Thank you very much.
Okay, guys. Thanks very much for joining us over these last 3 days. I hope you found these roundups interesting. And next week, we'll be getting on to some interviews with some top-performing freelance creatives and hopefully get some tips, tricks, advice, content, some great ideas that will help you, as I say in the show description, get better clients, do more interesting work, and make yourself a better living. Thanks for joining us again. Ciao.